This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. Affordable housing has always been scarce in Charlotte, and the city's rampant growth and changing tastes are putting that housing at even greater risk. For many, affordable homes are the ones they've been living in for decades. Many of those homes are in older, closer-in neighborhoods, and as more people choose to live closer to the center city, those neighborhoods are being transformed. Older homes are being sold and replaced by newer, more expensive houses, and that is causing many long-term residents to have to find other affordable housing options if they can. And even for those who stay behind, they may eventually find themselves priced out of their long-term homes. There's a very nice name for this, gentrification, but it doesn't always have nice consequences. So this hour, we meet some folks who are directly affected by this trend and hear about what could be a first-of-its-kind means of slowing down the effects of gentrification by creating permanently affordable housing. Ricky Hall is a longtime West Side resident and community activist who lives in Reed Park. In fact, he's lived there his entire life. Over 40 years, he's worked on a number of affordable housing efforts, but is now a board member of that one-of-a-kind effort I referred to a moment ago, the West Side Community Land Trust. Ricky Hall, welcome to the program.
Thank you, Mike.
Greg Jarrell is also a West Side resident who lives in Enderley Park, and he too is a board member of the West Side Community Land Trust. Welcome to you.
Thanks, Mike.
And Daryl Gaston is president of the Druid Hills Neighborhood Association on the city's north side. He grew up in the neighborhood and lives in his grandmother's house. His neighborhood may undergo significant change with the arrival of Camp North End. That's a massive project being developed by a New York investor, which we talked about on an earlier program. Mr. Gaston is working to encourage people to hold on to their homes and stay in the neighborhood. Welcome to you.
Thank you.
Nice to have you here.
Good morning.
Our listeners have been giving us story ideas through our Ask Us feature on our website, and then they're voting on the stories for our reporters to cover. And the topic of gentrification was the clear winner in the latest round of voting. We were asked, what is the next part of town to get gentrified, and where will those current residents go? David Borax will address those questions tomorrow on Morning Edition, and you can also read and listen to that story this evening on our website. But let me ask you that question. Where are the next areas to succumb to gentrification? Are they yours?
Absolutely. The West Side is certainly an area for gentrification. If you look at the close proximity of the West Side to some of the city's largest economic development generators, whether it be the airport, the planned River District, South End, or even the Central Business District area uptown, you see burgeoning the development taking place, but you also see rapid signs of gentrification, and on a daily basis, residents in our communities are being bombarded with offers to acquire their land.
I want to talk about that, but the second part of that question is also an important one. Where do the people go when they're either forced out because they're renters and the landlord decides to sell, or they get an offer they just can't refuse and they take that money and run? Where do they run to? Because affordable housing is in short supply. Where are they going?
Well, that's part of the trouble, and that's part of the reason that when I talk about gentrification, I tend to frame it in terms of displacement, mm-hmm. because that's the real social issue that's going on. That we have a long history in this city, but across the country, from the beginnings of the settling of this land, of displacing poor people of color from places that they have lived, where they've had the right, the access to land, to nurture their families and themselves, to grow businesses. And so the displacement of those people into other places that are deemed to be less fashionable sort of stands in a long progression.
Well, I didn't know this till yesterday, but the term gentrification actually originated in England,
right,
in the 1960s, when they were going through their own wave of people moving closer into center cities in England and displacing middle class or lower middle class, working class people,
right,
with richer people, younger people, which is happening here. But there's also here in this country a racial component to it, because the Absolutely. Neighborhoods that are being gentrified are historically black neighborhoods.
Absolutely.
So what does that mean to the neighborhood? It's not just people being displaced. you point out, I think both of you, Ricky and Gerald, Ricky and Daryl, point out that this is changing the character, the historic character of these neighborhoods.
I think that for the Druid Hills community more specifically, which initially was a all-white community, right, it transitioned to black or African-American, and now we see the integrity and the fabric of the neighborhood changing with individuals moving in of different racial backgrounds, which is not so bad. I understand that as human beings, we all need somewhere to live. But when we think about the connectivity of people who reside in Druid Hills, we are close-knit individuals who speak to each other, who are very welcoming, who look out for each other as it relates to crime and safety efforts to do away with disorder in the communities. But sometimes we experience individuals who move into the corridor who are not so friendly, who are not so welcoming, and who are not into speaking and being cordial. So I think that that compromises.
Who are these people? Are they charlatans, or are they coming from someplace else and moving here?
Well, some of the individuals are charlatans, and some of them are individuals who have moved to the city from various places across the country.
And are most of the people who live in Druid Hills, your area of town, are they long-term residents of the city who have not only lived here a long time, but they've lived in that neighborhood for a long time?
Yes, we do have many individuals in the Druid Hills community who have lived there for 50, 60, 70 years.
Wow.
Actually, on yesterday, I had the opportunity to spend some time with a resident who is 95 years old, and she actually worked at the quartermaster, now known as Camp North.
Right.
She packed TNT into shells for the World War II, and she has lived in Druid Hills for 65 years of her life. There's another lady that I know who has been in the quarter for 70 years. So we have many, many longtime residents.
So as I mentioned, Ricky, this is called gentrification. That's the nice word put to it. Others call it revitalization. Are they one and the same, and do you see these as interchangeable terms, gentrification and revitalization?
No, you can have gentrification without revitalization. If you look at, let me go back to the question you asked about the history of the areas like where I grew up. In the West Boulevard corridor, African Americans have been on that land ever since the end of the Civil War. When you look at the history of communities there, those communities, many of those communities were started by African-American landowners, and some of those communities that developed around those were overlayments of communities that were built and homes that were for white citizens in the community. And then when white flight changed some of the landscape, then African-Americans began to move into those neighborhoods that were being left behind. And so when I talk about it, I'm looking at the history, the heritage, and the culture of the community that is now starting to change as a result of
reverse white flight.
Yes, absolutely.
Because they're coming back, right?
Absolutely.
Greg, those who benefit from gentrification obviously like the word. It sounds upscale. You don't like the word. You say that when we talk about gentrification, we make the silent assumption that the land speculation, rising property tax income, adaptive reuse, and the increased hip factor that follow are, in fact, a public good. They're not?
Not necessarily. I think as we talk about building public spaces, as we talk about building common spaces, neighborhoods where we share in our lives together, and neighborhoods are really the foundational building block of a city, then we have to be sure that we're building those spaces in ways that are able to include all varieties of residents.
Well, I'm going to ask an uncomfortable question here.
Sure.
Because usually when we talk about gentrification of these traditionally African-American neighborhoods, we're talking about white flight in reverse, people coming back. I have two gentlemen here who are black, and you're white.
Sure am.
Aren't you part of the problem?
I probably am. and so I take it as incumbent for myself to work with folks like Daryl and Ricky against this problem, because displacement is physical and it's also cultural.
Let me get personal here, because you live in Enderley Park, right? Which is a traditionally African American neighborhood. You bought there because?
I moved there 12 years ago as part of a nonprofit that I was starting that has been working with children and youth primarily in that area.
Did you displace anybody by living there, either renting or buying there?
The house that I bought was vacant at the time.
Okay.
So in that sense, no. However, I'm very aware that even there was a study published in the New York Times several weeks ago that even the presence of white folks in a neighborhood visually can be one of the things that sort of starts this displacement ball rolling.
So what about that, gentlemen? I mean, here's a guy who's trying to be on your side, but let's face it, he's come into the neighborhood. There goes the neighborhood. So what do you say to that?
Well, personally, I think that when we talk about gentrification, we also have to consider reinvestment. Is it gentrification or is it reinvestment? I look at Greg's presence in the Enderley Park neighborhood as being one of reinvestment, because he's working for the common good of all individuals.
Okay.
And in our collaborative efforts, we are intentional about having eyes for people and not really getting caught up on skin color or race. And I think that his presence in the community does bring up some questions of concern, but I think that as we engage and he engages with residents in the corridor, people understand that he is here to help us, not to hurt.
So I guess what I'm trying to get at here is you perceive him as a good guy, and he is trying to do things, which we'll talk about later in the program, that actually do help, and among them the land trust, but there are other things as well. But how do you know, how do you self-identify? How does somebody who's looking at Enderley Park, because they want to live closer in and they want to move out of wherever they live now and be closer to the city, how do they see themselves as a good guy? Maybe they do see themselves as a good guy. What makes them a good guy?
Sure. Nobody ever wants to be identified as a gentrifier.
Right.
Right? It's always somebody else. Go ahead.
I think it goes back to a kind of a history and a legacy of Charlotte's housing patterns. When you have white flight and people move to the suburbs, it wasn't because of the people that were coming in didn't want people living beside them. It was because people that moved out didn't want people of a different persuasion living beside them.
Right.
What Greg represents is the wave of the future. And I think the future of Charlotte in terms of housing dynamics, housing diversity, and having diverse communities. I don't see it as necessarily being a bad thing, but I do see it if you look at housing and communities that rapidly turn over and they're all one particular color.
Ricky Hall is from Reed Park. He's a board member of the West Side Community Land Trust. We will continue in a moment on Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and Hendrick Volkswagen of Concord, offering a summer selection of vehicles, new and used. Details at Hendrick Volkswagen of Concord, at the Hendrick Auto Mall, Concord Mills, or HendrickVW of Concord.com. The Citizens Review Board holds a hearing on CMPD's internal exoneration of the officer who shot Keith Lamont Scott nearly a year ago. Teacher and principal pay raises highlight the newly approved CMS budget. Governor Cooper comes to town to announce the expansion of a company bringing 2,500 jobs to Charlotte. And the PGA has been here all week. We hear about those stories and more on the Local News Roundup coming up tomorrow on this program at 9. Thank you.
I'm Tom Asbrook. Coming up on the next On Point, President Trump threatens North Korea with fire and fury. Is he taking the country to war? And what would that look like? That's coming up on the next On Point from NPR.
On Point, coming up at 10, right after Charlotte Talks. Here on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE. Charlotte's NPR news source.
It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE. I'm Mike Collins, not to mention Facebook Live, where we are this morning, as we normally are. We're talking about gentrification with three people who know it well and two of whom are working, well, I think they're all working against it, but the two of whom are participating in what may be a first-of-its-kind project in Charlotte, the Westside Community Land Trust, which we'll talk about later. Ricky Hall is here. He's a Reed Park resident and board member of that land trust. Greg Jarrell is Enderley Park resident and a board member of that land trust. And Daryl Gaston is here. He's the president of the Druid Hills Neighborhood Association on the north side of town. We spoke with several people, Daryl, involved with the Camp North. Is it called North End? Camp North End, is that what it's called? Camp North End project, including that New York developer who's in charge of it. And they want to be, they say, an integral part of that north side area, but in your opinion, is that possible without fundamentally changing the character of your neighborhood?
Well, I think that it is possible if they are intentional about being inclusive of all people, and if they are intentional about how they develop the land.
But if they develop the land, doesn't that start a domino effect? If they're successful in changing their part of that neighborhood, isn't it going to do exactly what South End did and just trickle out year by year, week by week, month by month, and become something other than what it is now?
Well, I say this. Change comes slow, but it comes. And the developer, the city of Charlotte, and the residents of the North End Corridor have an opportunity to get this development right. We've had many examples here in the city of Charlotte where we did not get it right. So we can learn from our mistakes, and if we're intentional about development in the right kind of way, and even if we consider affordable housing to some degree at the Camp North location, I think that would be positive. Now, the North End Community Coalition, which is inclusive of Graham Heights, Druid Hills, Lockwood, Bright Walk at Historic Double Oaks, Greenville, Genesis Park, and the park at Oaklawn, as well as J.T. Williams, we're in the process of implementing a grant that we received from Unite Charlotte to help individuals walk through the tax abatement program, to help people understand the importance of bringing your homes up to code, to help people understand how they can capitalize off of the change that is taking place and that will take place in the corridor.
When I asked Daryl, Ricky, a minute ago about this incremental change, if that major project at Camp North End is successful, and it probably will be, that eventually it's going to creep out like South End has creeped out, and you live in the West Side corridor, the West Boulevard corridor, that comes right up to the edge of South End. When gentrification occurs, old construction goes away, new construction comes in, the character of neighborhoods begins to change. Some would say they've upgraded the neighborhood because you've replaced a $100,000 house with a $700,000 house. How could that be bad? Is that bad?
Yes, it's bad. It's because it erodes the affordability of housing that has been traditionally affordable to families and residents in the community. I have a concern when we get a lot of new development because the lack of some public policy perspectives that doesn't really keep in check the opportunities to make sure that there is inclusive housing for all sectors of need. And so when you bring in new development like the one that's proposed or the Brooklyn Village, generally the housing affordability is on the higher end and thus pushing out people that are on the lower end, and we don't have public policies like inclusionary zoning, which would require that you build some housing for different housing types to be more inclusive.
And we don't have that because isn't there a state law that prohibits the city from doing that?
Yes, there's.
Not exactly.
Exactly.
Not exactly. It's sort of complicated.
All right. Well, do we need to go into it?
Maybe later.
This is your chance. Later could be tomorrow.
Go ahead.
Let me just say this, and I want to make sure that our listeners understand that Charlotte-Mecklenburg has an affordable housing crisis, particularly for families at or below 60% of area median income. We are losing ground, even from the city's perspective. 17 years ago, we had a deficit of 15,000 units of housing, of affordable housing. And with all of the development, with all of the monies poured into housing trust funds and the building by affordable housing entities, today in 2017, we've increased that twofold. Now we have a 34,000 unit shortage, and we are seeing we're losing ground in terms of housing stock that was once affordable that is now turning over rapidly.
So when you look at areas like Cherry, and that's being rapidly developed, that's where you're losing ground.
That's where we're losing ground.
Those houses are the older houses are
definitely.
You wrote Greg an article for Charlotte Agenda where you spelled out the way a lot of people living in those neighborhoods right now, the older neighborhoods, the older neighbors, feel about people coming in. You say they understand why these new people want to come in because it's close in, because of the architecture, because of short commutes, because of walkability, because of the character of the neighborhood. That's why they understand people want to come. But you also pointed out that a lot of people living in those neighborhoods are the ones who created that character while facing economic, political, and social oppression. We don't think about that. Talk about that for a second.
Sure. So a neighborhood is a piece of land generally in our economy we think about simply as a commodity. So land is traded, oftentimes traded in investment portfolios with people who've never even stepped foot on the land, right? But for people who live in neighborhoods, you become adopted to the particular shape of the land, to the way the houses line up together across the street, to the way that neighbors learn to interact in the places that are created. And so in Enderley Park, for where I live, for instance, we have this beautiful, thriving kind of underground economy that helps everybody to survive, even in the face of significant poverty. So that gets eroded.
I'm sorry, what does that mean, underground economy?
It means that the things that aren't easily quantifiable make for a really rich culture of folks caring for one another, of folks making sure that people have what they need, that when there are dangerous situations, that there are neighbors who can help to resolve those situations.
So it's over time has become a neighborhood in the truest sense of the word.
Sure, absolutely. It's absolutely.
True social capital.
Right. Okay. And so part of what happens with these changes is that though that culture gets displaced.
Right.
And so particularly in places of poverty that have strong natural helping networks, those helping networks where folks care for one another get pushed out to other areas.
And even if newcomers want to build those same threads among their neighbors, it takes time. It
takes years.
Yes, because trust has to be earned over time. The flip side of this is that no one can force you to sell your house. I mean, people have come up to – I actually had this happen to me. Somebody knocked on the door and wanted to buy my house. It wasn't for sale.
Right.
So – and that's happening throughout these neighborhoods. Their signs are going up. You pointed out that a few minutes ago. They're getting flyers in their mailbox say, we buy houses unseen. I'm sure I get those in my mailbox. So – but no one can force you to sell, right?
That's true. But when you look at the predatory nature of areas that are deemed high value now, there's a lot of housing speculation going on. And every day, somebody is either knocking at your door or they're constantly sending you offers to buy your house out of quick.
Wearing you down.
Yes.
Are they paying fair market value?
No.
No. Under fair market value.
They're paying significantly under fair market value.
Yeah. And there are lots of stories of folks using, of investors working in a predatory nature to use code enforcement to help in sort of bullying people along. So there are lots of people around our city who are house and equity rich, but cash poor.
Right.
And so vulnerable to that sort of.
So if somebody's in a home and they're offered, what's the average offer among these people that are sending flyers and putting up signs?
Cash, no question.
Well, how much?
Well, most of the individuals who are seeking the homes in the inner city neighborhoods are offering just a little above tax value. So sometimes it's $50,000, $60,000, $70,000, and sometimes it's even less than that.
And tax value is well below market value.
Definitely.
And thank God for it. But that's a problem. But to a lot of people who don't have never seen that kind of money in cash, this is a once-in-a-lifetime windfall, isn't it? And that's where the temptation comes in.
Well, I think it feels that way. It can feel like a once-in-a-lifetime windfall.
So but you can take that money. And what can you do with it? Can you find a house of equal value somewhere else?
Well, no. Let's say, for instance, if I were to sell my home house in Druid Hills for $200,000, $200,000 would not afford me an opportunity to go and purchase a quality home with the amount of land that I currently possess.
So if you have the intestinal fortitude to not succumb to these people who are asking to buy your house and you decide to stay, why then does the neighborhood ultimately become unaffordable to you over time?
Because of tax.
Talk about that.
Typically we're taxed out because if we have someone to come in and build a three-story home that's has a value of $400,000 or $500,000 next to a single dwelling bungalow that has a value of maybe $70,000, then his cousin or brother comes in and does the same thing, and it becomes contagious.
So if your street, which has a $150,000 house on it, on every piece of land, suddenly becomes a street with $700,000, $800,000, $900,000 houses on it, mm-hmm. and you're still in your $100,000 house, mm-hmm. Your tax value is going to rise to the $800,000 level.
Perhaps.
Can't you call a tax assessor and say, look at the difference in my house versus that house?
Right. So this is particularly a problem for seniors who are living on fixed incomes.
Right.
And so your house may not rise to that $800,000 level, but your tax value certainly will rise to $400,000, $450,000.
And they
level.
Can't afford it.
Right. And so the taxes become unaffordable. There is state policy called the homestead exemption that can eliminate some of those taxes, but the threshold at which those taxes are reduced is very low. And so there's a state policy issue that needs to be addressed in order to increase that tax exemption to help our seniors to stay and age in place.
Daryl, if there was no gentrification, would some of these neighborhoods simply go into decline, or would they actually just remain stable the way they are today?
Well, I think that with education and with individuals who care about the integrity and of the corridor and their neighborhoods, that they can thrive again. I think that a lot of people don't have access to the resources, and that's one thing that our coalition NEC is trying to educate people about, that there are resources out there to help you bring your home up to code, to help you with your taxes, to help you with what it means to enhance neighborhood equity in the North End corridor.
You mentioned gentrification. Go ahead, Ricky.
But Mike, let me say, in terms of stable neighborhoods, yes, those neighborhoods would be stable. Let me just say that when you look at it from an issue of social and economic mobility, a problem which Charlotte has, it's not that these communities, in particular West Boulevard communities, hadn't remained stable over time. It's just that the ancillary needs of the community are being denied and haven't been met by traditional market forces.
Yeah. Yes.
We lack grocery stores. We have a food desert. In many instances, we lack access to health care other than the hospitals. And we also have other needs from an economic development standpoint in terms of business investment that only comes as a community is gentrified. We're not waiting for gentrification to come to bring those assets to us. We're actually doing it from a community-driven perspective, as a way of maintaining.
But how do you bring a Harris Teeter? You start your own version of Harris Teeter? How do you do it?
You don't have to bring Harris Teeter. We've tried that. Harris Teeter's not coming. We don't have to bring Publix. Publix is not coming. We've tried that. And so for 40 years, for example, in the West Boulevard corridor, we've been trying to get a Tier 1 or Tier 2 grocery store. We're not doing that anymore. Since they won't come to us, what we've decided to do, we'll do it ourselves. And the co-op grocery store model is our roadmap.
Is it working?
Actually doing that.
Is it up and running?
It's not up and running.
Okay.
It's not there. But we're planning on it. We know what we have to do to get it. And we look to have it in the near future.
What Ricky is saying is really important, that our neighborhoods who appear to be in decline didn't get that way all of a sudden or accidentally. They got that way by a series of policy decisions made by city and municipal leaders over the past 40 or 50 years. They got that way because it's very difficult for people of color to get business loans and home loans still, and was even more difficult 20, 30 years ago, right? So there are policy
And they've gotten those loans in some cases at much higher rates of interest.
Right. And the home loan crisis, of course, predatory loans were given out over and over and over to people of color who then had their neighborhoods further destabilized. So there are intentional decisions that have been made that have put us in the place we're in now.
So when you talk, Daryl, about getting things right in terms of gentrification, what would right look like?
Right for me looks like being civic in design and by design. As Ricky stated, I would like to see housing for individuals who are young homeowners or desire to be young homeowners, that type of housing stock, middle class, and I'm not even opposed to the higher end of homes being included in the corridor. Mm. But I think that we have to consider our seasoned citizens. I think we have to consider those young professionals. I think we have to consider entrepreneurs. I think that we have to consider all individuals that come from a variety of backgrounds or walks of life when we think about housing, when we think about neighborhood equity, when we think about community.
When we come back from the break, I want to explore this new, at least to Charlotte, this new idea, which, as I said, could be a first of its kind for this city. It is in place in other places around the world. The West Side Community Land Trust, how that would work, what your aspirations are for it, and what effect it might have going forward. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members at the Blue Ridge Music Center, presenting Old Crow Medicine Show and Mipso Sunday, August 27th at 4:30 p.m. on the Blue Ridge Parkway near Galax, Virginia. Details at blueridgemusiccenter.org. President Trump threatens North Korea with fire and fury. Secretary of Defense Jim Mattis followed with strong language of his own. So what does this mean? For some, it makes the possibility of a military conflict over the North's nuclear program more real. So coming up in 20 minutes at 10 o'clock during On Point, they'll look at what's next for the U.S. and North Korea.
Robin Ciordia, owner of The Secret Chocolatier, a WFAE underwriter. I recommend underwriting with WFAE all the time. It has been the most worthwhile source that we have done for getting our name and our brand out there. I would definitely say that you can get new customers as well as remind your current customers what you're doing and who you are.
Find out more. Email underwriting@WFAE.org for details.
It's Charlotte Tux on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're talking about affordable housing, and we'll do a follow-up program on this later on, focusing on other affordable housing efforts around Charlotte. We're here with Ricky Hall and Greg Gerald. They're both board members of the Westside Community Land Trust, which we will spend time talking about in a moment. Daryl Gaston is also here from the Druid Hills neighborhood, where he is the president of the neighborhood association there. From Facebook, we have a comment. I know people in those Camp North End communities that are already being displaced. Houses are selling for ridiculous prices, but by that I assume he means low. I don't know. The effect has started. Can it be stopped?
I think that it can be stopped if people realize that they do not have to sell their homes. A lot of individuals are.
If you need the money. I mean, if somebody's presenting you $100,000 in cash.
Well, that may be that horse of a different color. If an individual needs to sell their home, that's okay, but we want them to be better off after the sale than they were prior to.
And people in that economic situation don't always know what the future may hold if they're suddenly presented with that $100,000 because they weren't planning to move. They haven't been real estate shopping. They're not online checking out Zillow to see what housing prices are. Are they? So if they sell, do they then suddenly wake up the next morning and realize they're in a pickle because they haven't done the homework yet?
I think that some individuals do wake up and realize that they are in a pickle because they've not done the research to know what it would cost to move and to find new housing that they would be happy and that would be suitable for them. And so many individuals are being displaced and selling their homes because they're either behind on taxes or the houses are in decay. But there are resources out there, and we have been intentional about trying to help people get the resources that they need.
And we is the Druid Hills Neighborhood Association?
The Druid Hills Neighborhood Association, the North End Community Coalition.
And in other neighborhoods, are there organizations doing similar work to what you're doing in your
area? I would offer that there are other organizations doing that work. To what degree, okay. I'm not so certain.
Karen on Facebook writes, gentrification in Plaza Midwood has gotten boring and crowded. The houses are the same in those awful apartments. Please stop this white breading of our neighborhoods. Two of the people trying to stop this are sitting at this table, and I'm talking about Ricky Hall and Greg Gerald. They're board members of this Westside Community Land Trust. This is a new approach. Where did the idea originate, though? Greg.
So there's been talk of building a community land trust in Charlotte for decades. Ricky's been part of those discussions for probably 40 years. But this kind of current energy behind it that has now formed an organization started with some community organizing kind of meetings about a year and a half ago where the idea was put forward, and some of us started researching how would this work and can we make it work.
So let's talk about how it will work because you're a nonprofit. You have to raise money to buy the land that we're talking about conserving or banking, which we'll talk about in a second. Where are you in that effort, Ricky?
Well, we're at the point in which we will certainly begin membership drives, and there are other opportunities for us to acquire money through grants and loans and even acquire money from local municipalities.
How much money do you need to do what you want to accomplish? Hundreds? Millions?
Yes.
Millions.
But there's no doubt.
But you can do it. You don't have to have it all at once.
You don't have to have it all at once. And when people, we think that when the community understands how the community land trust is not necessarily a panacea for Charlotte's affordable housing crisis, but it can stem the tide of this rampant loss of housing, affordable housing,
right.
Then the community will kick in, and we will generate the dollars and support necessary to sustain the land trust and keep affordable housing in perpetuity.
You may be the beneficiary of a good omen here, because as I was reading about community land trusts yesterday, the abbreviation for community land trust is the same as that for our airport.
Right. CLT.
CLT. So maybe that's a good omen. Let's see. So how does this work? You come in, you buy what? Properties that maybe these people who are putting flyers in mailboxes would buy. You buy the property, then what?
So there are lots of ways to acquire property. The goal is to acquire that property and then to hold it in trust, which means to hold it in perpetuity.
Or somebody could pass away and deed it to you?
Yes.
Sure.
Yes.
Absolutely.
Absolutely.
We certainly welcome that. We have a person right now who is splitting a large lot and giving us the vacant part of that lot.
Does it matter to you whether these pieces of land are contiguous or whether they're just scattered all over the place?
It doesn't matter to us.
Okay.
We're focusing on the west side. And the way that this works is that we will build housing, we'll construct housing on land or renovate housing if it's already there. And then the house is sold to a homeowner separate from the land that the house is constructed
on. You retain ownership of the land trust retains ownership of the land. The house belongs to whomever buys it.
That's right.
Yes.
Okay.
That's right. So there are some 200 organizations who do this around the country. Almost all the big cities in the country have organizations like this.
Is it working well in those areas?
It's working very well in a lot of places.
Because this seems to be a concept that would be scary for a lot of people, because why would I buy a house that's sitting on land that I don't own? What happens if you guys go bankrupt or decide I'm done with this, or the board falls apart, or somebody gets a great idea and sells it to a developer and I got a house sitting on land that I don't own and the developer says, get off? Do I put the house on wheels and move? How do I protect myself? How does the bank protect its mortgage on my house?
Sure. So these questions have been raised in all kinds of places, right? And so we're working with Durham Community Land Trustees, which has been around for about 40 years and have been learning from them. And at this point, we have not acquired property because we're trying to establish a very strong base for this organization. We want it to last 200 years or more, right? And so in order to do that, it needs strong people power and it needs strong structure in place. But then after we're able to build some housing and to sell it, the high cost of housing is really driven by the cost of land. You know, the real estate rule is location, location, location.
Because they're not making any more land.
Right, right. And so by eliminating the cost of land from the cost of housing, that's how we're able to keep that housing affordable in the long term.
Right. How do you control the cost of the actual structure? Or do you? You don't care. Do you not care? In other words, if you hold the land, can I come in there and build $1 million house on it?
No.
Or do I have to come in there and build $150,000 or $250,000 house?
So the land trust itself will build the house and sell it.
Okay.
And do so with income restrictions built into it.
Mm-hmm. So only people in certain income categories can purchase that house.
Absolutely. They can purchase that house. But the other asset of that house is that the homeowner A, who buys the house initially, agrees to buy that house. And, of course, from the ownership of that house, they gain equity that will then, if they decide to sell that house, they can. But the land trust exercises this option to buy back that house. The homeowner A gets equity that they can then move on to bigger and better things if that's what they want to do. But that housing price point still remains the same for the next family
coming in. You're capping how much money I can make in terms of appreciation.
Right. The equity is capped in the contract. So there's both a floor and a ceiling that's built into it as a manner of helping to control the cost of housing.
Yes.
How do you get somebody to buy into that concept? Because people have always been told, it's not true, by the way, but they have been told that housing is an investment.
Right.
And it's not true.
It's important. It's important that it's not true.
It's not true.
Right.
But that's what they think.
Right.
And it is most people's largest, quote, investment, unquote. So if they've been taught that their entire lives and they see this structure as a piggy bank, I'm going to buy this house, I'm going to live in this house for 15 years, and by gosh, I'm going to walk away with $150,000 more than I put into it. And you're saying, oh, no, you're not, because we're going to keep it low. Why would I buy that house?
Sure. So the folks that we want to be able to sell housing to are likely folks that would not be able to buy housing otherwise, right? So there is a trade-off. If you buy into the community land trust, then you buy a house that you won't make the full equity off of, right? But displacement is cultural as well as physical. And so the trade-off is the ability to build a strong, lasting, authentically diverse community that you get to be a part of, that your children get to be a part of. And does it cost you some money in the long run? Maybe. The housing market doesn't always increase. Sometimes it decreases.
Exactly right. So what about taxes? Because I'm going to buy this house. Whatever it is, you're going to build this house. I know I'm not going to be able to sell it for a gazillion dollars eventually. You're going to cap that. But you own the land, and the county is going to tax that land. And if somebody next door to me on a piece of property that you don't own puts up $1.5 million house, isn't that going to raise the tax payment on my property? Who pays the taxes? I don't own the land. Do I pay the taxes only on the structure? Do you pay the taxes on the land? And if the land value goes up, isn't that all your capital going into taxes?
So nonprofits who work in affordable housing can become exempt from paying real estate tax.
Real estate taxes.
So we'll bank on that as helping us out.
Right.
So but as a homeowner, I would be paying real estate taxes on the structure.
The value of the structure.
On the value of the structure. So you're telling me that Mecklenburg County taxpayers elsewhere are going to pick up the difference because the tax base is about to be lowered by this. Is that right?
Sure. but taxpayers pick up the difference, for instance, in your mortgage interest write-off,
right?
But that funnels wealth upwards, and we're trying to funnel wealth downwards.
And these homeowners and these land trusts around the country pay an annual fee. Is that right, to be part of land trust? What's that? How much is that fee generally, and what does it go for? What do you use the money for?
Generally, it's a fairly small fee, $25, $30 a month. And it goes to the maintenance of the organization and the maintenance of the property as needed.
And what happens if something happens to the land trust organization itself? It falls apart for some reason. It goes bankrupt for some reason. What happens then?
Well, Mike, we're not planning for.
Well, of course, you're not
the
planning on
failure
that.
Of,
but what,
of
happens,
the land
if
trust.
But what happens if it does? But what happens if it does? I have a house that's sitting on property that you own.
But let me say this. If you look at the history of land trust in the U.S. started back in the late 60s with the civil rights movement.
Okay.
And the concept has grown to just about every state in the union. And so we're not planning on the failure of the land trust. We're actually planning on the long-term sustainability as a way of maintaining housing affordability in perpetuity.
But you see, I'm risk-averse. So I'm just asking you from a point of view of a risk-averse person, what happens to my house if you guys fall apart?
According to the IRS, if a nonprofit closes, then the assets that it owns have to be given over to a similarly purposed nonprofit organization.
Right.
The Westside Community Land Trust, your organization, is looking to serve these zip codes, 28208, 28214, 28216, and 28217. That's the West Trade Beatty's Ford Corridor, the Freedom Tuckasegee Corridor, the Wilkinson Corridor, and the West Boulevard Corridors. If you are successful in rounding up enough land to keep large swaths of land affordable in perpetuity, when that's the goal here, do you run the risk of putting a damper on future development of those areas? Are you condemning them to being like they are today, or are you opening the door to investors coming in, businesses coming in, and saying this is a stable neighborhood that we can feel secure in opening a business in?
It's the latter versus the first. We're not putting a damp on any development. In actuality, we're being inclusive and creating a more diverse community. What you're actually seeing in areas like the South End and other areas are areas where there is kind of like exclusivity. If poorer residents are being forced to move out and not being taking advantage of other amenities that are growing in the city, that's not inclusive. We can, in this community, live together. And the one way in which the land trust actually benefits communities is by encouraging investment rather than disinvestment and having a more inclusive community.
You wrote an article, Greg, in the Charlotte Agenda that I referred to a while ago, in which you also laid out some road less traveled prescriptives for ways we can fix this affordable housing crunch. And I don't think we have time to go into them. I just want to read some of these. You referred to these as practices of neighborliness that can bridge the racial and economic divides. Among them, stop worrying about your property values. Send your kids to nearby public schools. Fight for affordable housing. There were others. But how do you stop people worrying about property values?
We have to stop you have to stop believing the lie that if you have enough money, it'll save you. That's Pharaoh's way of thinking, right?
All right, we're going to have you come back and talk about this because these are revolutionary.
Let's do that. Yeah.
And they go against the grain, but it's interesting. That's Greg Jarrell, Enderley Park, and a board member of Westside Community Land Trust, along with Ricky Hall, also a board member, and Daryl Gaston, president of the Druid Hills Neighborhood.